So before I start with new material, are there any questions about what we discussed yesterday or about the tutorial? Hopefully, so far, I mean, so far so good. Yeah, so yesterday we discussed the geometry of conformal transformations, and we derived the most general conformal transformation in Minkowski space. And that's the vector field that generates those infinitesimal conformal transformations. And we associated certain generators to each of the parameters that parametrize the most general conformal Killing vector. Some of them were familiar, some maybe not completely familiar, but that's the most general solution. And then we saw that there's a special disconnected conformal transformation inversion that essentially allows you to generate the full conformal group, including the disconnected components, starting from, say, translation or Poincaré, and making a semi-direct product with inversion. Okay. So yesterday I discussed how inversion, conjugating translations by inversion, gives you special conformal transformations. You can check that, of course, if you conjugate any of the other conformal transformations with inversion, you get one of the conformal generators. Okay, and you can check that this is what you get. Okay, so this is this was all about kinematics. I mean, we didn't discuss about field theory. This was just pure geometry. So in this lecture, what I want to start studying is how these transformations are implemented in quantum field theory. Okay. Good. So also, in order to connect with a bit of the tutorial that you did yesterday, so what are we going to do? So we're going to study conformal field theory, which is by definition a theory that has these symmetries. Invariant under SO2, D. Remember that the conformal algebra, we proved that it's SO2, D. And this was an enhancement from a usual quantum field theory, which only has Poincaré symmetry, which would be ISO. One d minus one. Okay, so this is an enhancement from Poincaré algebra to the conformal algebra. So in quantum field theory, yes.
Is there an easy way to see why the last one's true? IDI is equal to negative d.
Yeah. Well, in a certain sense, because you're dilating in the opposite direction. If you follow the arrow, it changes the orientation. So a dilation moves a sphere outwards. So if you do that, you're coming in the opposite direction. Yeah. So in quantum field theory, in standard quantum field theory you've been studying so far, you all operators are fit into representations of Poincaré, right? You say that, actually, we usually only care about the Lorentz part, because Poincaré just acts by translations. The translations act by derivatives, essentially. So you say that you have an operator, and it can be a Lorentz scalar, it can be a Lorentz vector, it can be a spinor, blah, blah, blah. So we fit operators into representations of the Poincaré algebra. Now, of course, if we're in a conformal field theory, if you have a theory that has conformal symmetry, operators will have to be in representations of the conformal algebra. Okay. So that's a bigger algebra, and they have to furnish some representations. And what we're going to study today is, so you're familiar about the representation theory of, say, the Lorentz group. Now we're going to see how we have to label operators in a conformal field theory. What are the quantum numbers? So in a relativistic quantum field theory, we label operators essentially by the spin of the operator. Here we will have to add an extra label, which will be the eigenvalue or the quantum number of the operator under the dilatation operator. Okay. So we're going to label operators by dilatation, scaling dimension. The eigenvalue under dilatation is the scaling dimension, and by the Lorentz spin. Okay. But before we go there, I want to connect a little bit with what you did yesterday in the exercise. So the first point I want to make is that in any local quantum field theory, conformally invariant or not, there exists a canonical operator. So what is this operator? There's the identity operator, but something more interesting. So by a local, I always meant relativistic quantum field theory. So translational invariance implies what? So by Noether's theorem, it implies that there is a conserved current associated to each asymmetry in your theory. And translational invariant defines a very important operator that is at the heart of all of physics, which is the energy momentum tensor. Okay? So translational invariant implies that there is an operator, T mu nu, which is the energy momentum tensor. And Noether's theorem implies that this current is conserved. Okay? This is just a statement that that the energy momentum tensor is divergence free on shell, okay? By using the equations of motion. Lorentz invariance implies that this operator, the energy momentum tensor, is symmetric, can be made symmetric. So now one thing that you can ask is, okay, so a conformal field theory is a quantum field theory with extra symmetries, okay? So that must mean that in a conformal field theory, the energy momentum tensor of that theory has additional properties. Okay? So I just want to discuss a little bit the properties that the energy momentum tensor in a conformal field theory has, and we will connect, hopefully it will ring a bell with what you were doing yesterday, okay? Yeah, so I don't know how. How much I should go into it, but. Good. So, one definition of the energy momentum tensor that is very useful, and it can be taken to be a canonical definition, is by taking your field theory and coupling it to gravity. And then, you know, the energy momentum tensor is the variation of the action with respect to the metric, right? So you know that if you take your action and you make a diffeomorphism, arbitrary diffeomorphism, that you're going to get, okay, the factors of two and all of that, I'm not going to be very careful, but this essentially is the definition of the energy momentum tensor, right? It measures the response of the system to a change in the metric, okay? And this is true for an arbitrary diffeomorphism, okay? And we know that under arbitrary diffeomorphism, this guy essentially is d mu, zeta nu, plus d nu, zeta mu. You know this from general relativity, okay? Now, imagine that we do a conformal transformation. Then we know that this, what the right-hand side of this thing is. Can someone tell me what the right-hand side of this thing is? Can we simplify this equation a little bit? That was the conformal Killing vector equation, right? So it's something like 2 over d eta mu nu divergence of this, right? OK, good. So I'm going to use this. OK, this was a horrible eta, but. And I can plug it here for a conformal transformation. So now what am I going to get? I'm going to get T mu nu contracted with eta mu nu. That's the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So, okay, forget about factors of two. It's not important. So I'm going to write contracting T mu nu with eta mu nu gives me the energy momentum, the trace of the energy momentum tensor. This will be a very important object, as you will see in a minute, times the divergence of the conformal Killing vector. So now we can understand from this simple picture what are the constraints, the energy momentum tensor, that are imposed if your theory has the additional symmetry. So we already summarized the properties that the energy momentum tensor has to have by virtue of translations and by virtue of Lorentz transformations. Now let's ask, what should the energy momentum tensor of a theory that is dilatation invariant have? Okay. So if a dilatation is a symmetry, it means that the variation of the action is zero, right? That's what it means, that something is a symmetry. You implement the transformation, it has and the action vanishes. So if I do now a dilatation, the Killing vector of the dilatation was lambda x mu, right? Sorry, it was lambda x mu. So if I compute now the divergence of x mu of the Killing vector is just lambda, which is a constant, right? So the theory will be dilatation invariant if this thing vanishes for such transformation. So this tells you what property should the trace of the energy momentum have in order for this to be true. Can someone tell me? That's sufficient, it's not necessary. Is there another solution to this equation? It's a total derivative. So, and this should ring a bell with the homework yesterday. So dilatation invariance implies that the energy moment, the trace of the energy momentum tensor is the derivative of some operator. Because then this guy is a constant, and if it's a total derivative, I can kill it by partial integration, okay? Now let's look at so this is so now we have dealt with the first three. Let's deal with the last one, special conformal. Okay, mu. So now I'm not going to write this horrible thing, but now we have to look at this, what happens under this to this conformal Killing vector. Now the point is that the divergence of the conformal Killing vector now it's not a constant, it's linear in x, right? It's a linear function of x. So now what is what conditions should the trace of the energy momentum tensor obey so that this vanishes for psi being a conformal, special conformal transformation? Sorry? Two derivatives. Because this is linear in x, see, if it has two derivatives, it will kill it by integrating by parts. So a conformal field theory will be a theory that has the canonical as any local quantum theory energy momentum tensor, but it will have these very special properties that the trace of the energy momentum tensor can be written this way. It's a total derivative. And in fact, so this is something that actually I think Tibra took it out. He's being too nice. But at some point, I had an exercise where you could prove the following. So I'm going to state the result, and then you can try to prove it. So this is something that you may or may not have seen in your field theory courses. Whenever you have a conserved current in a quantum field theory, the current is not unique. Okay, you can redefine the current by what's called an improvement transformation that doesn't change the charge nor the conservation law. So imagine you have a current J mu and it's conserved. You know, the charge essentially is the integral of J zero, right? Over space. You've seen this, right? Now, no one forbids me from defining this object. I'm probably going to butcher it, but I'll try not to. Let's call it O. Okay, I'm calling everything O. L. M, it's an op- okay, so like I'll call it O. doesn't matter. Mu nu, with the property that this guy is antisymmetric in these two indices, okay? Now, if J mu was conserved, J mu tilde is also conserved. Is that obvious? I mean, it should be obvious. It's because this guy is conserved, and this guy would be symmetric, the median is symmetric, and this guy is antisymmetric. And notice that this guy is conserved, and the charge, if you wish Q tilde, is the same as Q, because I'm integrating something that's a total derivative. Okay? So the point is that when you have an energy, when I have a conserved current, you may choose to improve it. This is also a good advice in life. You should always try to improve yourself. And you can improve it in such a way that the trace of the energy momentum, the condition of conformal invariance for the trace of the energy momentum tensor looks nicer. So the thing that you could have shown if Tiber didn't eliminate it would have been that that you can prove that by an improvement transformation of this type, you can define from T mu nu a new energy momentum tensor T mu hat that will have all the same charges with the property that if T mu nu, sorry, if the trace of the energy momentum tensor is obeys this, so that's, again, this is a condition that this gadget is conformal invariant, then the trace of the improved energy momentum tensor vanishes. Okay. So another way of stating the condition of conformal invariance for the in a conformal field theory is that there exists an energy momentum tensor with vanishing trace. Okay. So that's how we characterize. This is the most basic characterization of a conformal field theory, that it has a local energy momentum tensor with vanishing trace. That essentially defines a conformal field theory. Now, can someone guess? Imagine you take a theory that's classically conformal invariant, and now you add a mass term. What will happen to the trace of the energy momentum tensor? Well, it will obviously not be zero anymore because it's not conformal invariant. But what I want you maybe to think about is that What will appear on the right-hand side are precisely the operators or the terms in the action that break conformal invariance. So if you add a mass term, you would get something like 1/2 m squared phi squared in a scalar field theory. Okay? So the non-vanishing of the energy momentum tensor measures violations of conformal invariance. Okay? So if imagine you don't know anything and you want to know if something is conformal invariant, one very brute force of doing it is to compute the trace of the energy momentum tensor and see if it's zero or non-zero. And later, next week, we will see that there are very subtle quantum violations of the conformal invariance condition that will give us some non-trivial right-hand side when we couple the field theory to a background curve, background metric. Okay. So, but let's not go there yet. So, does this connect a little bit with what you were doing yesterday? I believe in yesterday you were looking at a theory that was obviously a scale invariant on the nose, and that the energy momentum tensor obeyed these two equations, right? And then you could prove that by adding something that essentially give you another conserved tensor, you could write it to be traceless. Okay. The thing that you didn't do is that you could have done it more generally. You could have taken an abstract conformal field theory that has a conformal invariant energy momentum tensor of this property and then prove this. It's not very hard to do, and I encourage you to try to do it.
They were
in a flat background, yeah. Even though, okay, so I'm going to say a point that is, I think it's important. So even though we study the theory in flat, imagine we're interested only in the theory in flat space at the end of the day, one way to compute the energy momentum tensor that's very economical is to couple the theory to a background metric. Okay? That's very easy to do. Whenever you see eta mu nu, you put g mu nu. Okay? But now the point is the coupling of the theory to a background metric is not unique. You can have additional non-minimal couplings, for example, coupling to the curvature. And the choice of non-minimal couplings are in one-to-one correspondence with precisely the choice of improvement terms. So, okay, so since you mentioned, let me just make a parenthesis. One way in which you can prove this statement here is by using this language. So as I said, the improvement transformations have to do with inequivalent ways of coupling the theory to a background metric. So if you have, so this L mean u is some operator in your theory, right? So I can now do the following thing. I can couple my flat space theory to curved space in the usual way by replacing eta by g, right? By curve metric. But now I can also do this. Who forbids me? And the rule is the following. The rule is that I can add anything that I want here that has the property that when I go to flat space, I recover the flat space theory, right? Well, famously, the Riemann tensor vanishes in flat space, right? So I'm allowed to add here something like this. For example, and also something like this. Well, I think that this will suffice, okay? So this will be the Ricci tensor times L mu. Of course, if I go to flat space, I get the same theory, so that's fine. But now the important thing is that if I look at the energy momentum tensor of this theory alone, and this theory alone are different, right? Because I have to do the first variation with respect to the metric, and the Ricci tensor has a non-trivial first variation. And when I evaluate it in flat space, it gives you a new contribution. Okay? So then you can show that by appropriately tuning a coefficient here, you can always go from this condition to this condition. Okay? So improvement transformations have, the way I like to think more about it more physically is that these improvement transformations have to do with choices of coupling your theory to curved space. Yes.
So I was wondering if the right-hand side of that equality, the right-hand side, it should be m squared or the beta function of m squared.
Yeah, and the beta function of, well, it should be the beta function of m squared times the operator. And that's precisely that.
OK,
thanks. Would using this condition that the trace should vanish give you an indication of what term should be there? In a curved space, in a curved space time
QFT. So can you repeat that? I didn't
understand. If you wanted to make a QFT in curved space time, would this condition that the trace should vanish give you an indication of what terms should be there?
Well, the point is that there's only one, you can parameterize with the most general term that you can add here that would modify the energy momentum tensor and it would not vanish once you go to flat space. And the most general thing you can write down here, what is it? What is the, essentially you can only add something that's linear in the Riemann tensor. The Riemann tensor has a property that if you take a variation and you evaluate it in flat space, it's non-zero. Imagine you put Riemann square and you look at the first variation. I mean, when you compute the energy momentum tensor, you look at the first variation of the action, right? So if you look at like terms like Riemann square or Riemann to the 75, if you do the variation and then evaluate in flat space, you're going to get zero. So the most general term that you can write here actually would be something like R mu nu rho sigma and some operator mu nu rho sigma in general. Is that what you were asking? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like you wouldn't always need those terms to.
No, it depends. So some theories, it may happen that in the nose, it's already in this frame, and in some cases, it doesn't. For example, if you take a massless fermion, it just happens, or the Maxwell field. If you evaluate the trace of the Maxwell field, it just happens that it's zero in four dimensions. You don't have to add any cookie. Okay. So I as usual, I speak too much. Okay. So now we're going to. So this operator is present in all local quantum field theories. And in particular, in all conformal field theories, and they have these nice properties. Now we're going to discuss. So I think I'm going to. Can someone remind me not to raise this? Okay, that's your job today. So okay. I will probably forget and erase it anyway. But okay, so now we want to discuss operators in a conformal field theory. So this will go very much in parallel with the discussion that you already know for relativistic quantum field theory. So operators will be in representations of the conformal algebra. Okay? Which is what we discussed last time. Okay? And as I said, so now what you can do is, you, as we are familiar from quantum mechanics, you label operators by the, if you wish, by the maximal set of commuting operators. You diagonalize the maximal commuting set of operators, and that gives you the quantum numbers for the operator. So that means that we're going to label operators by quantum numbers under, what did I call it? M? Lorentz and dilatations. Okay? These guys commute with each other, and exactly you can check that this is the maximally commuting set. More generally, whenever you have a non-compact group, the representation theory is labeled, the highest weight representations are labeled by the maximal compact subgroup, which in this case is just Lorentz and dilatation. Okay? Now, what is the quantum number associated to Lorentz? Well, we already know this. This is Lorentz spin, right? Spin zero, spin a half, blah, blah, blah. And dilatations is the gadget that we talked about a lot in the other lectures, delta, which is the scaling dimension. So now you see why we care so much about the scaling dimension, because this is the quantum number that labels the operator, and it determines the correlation function of the theory, as we will see today. If we get there. Okay. So all operators in a conformal field theory are in a representation of the conformal algebra, and representation, and operators can be of either two types. They can be either primary, which are primary, gives you the sense that they are the simple ones. These are the ones that transform simply under conformal transformations. And then you have descendants. If you wish, the primary operators are the operators that transforms as linear tensors under conformal transformations. You're familiar from general relativity about the notion of a tensor? Primary operators are tensors, while descendant operators are not tensors, but conformal invariance tells you that their properties are fully determined by a primary operator. So if you wish, a primary operator is like a parent, and a descendant has always a parent. I mean, we all have a parent. And the properties of the descendant are completely determined in terms of those of the parent. So therefore, if you want to solve the theory, it suffices to constrain all the primaries, because all the properties of the associated descendants are completely fixed. In a simple way, okay? Good. So let's start cooking. So remember yesterday when I wrote down the conformal algebra, you noticed, and again, we're trying to diagonalize the dilatation operator, right? We noticed that P was a raising operator for D, and K was a lowering operator. This should remind you of, say, the representation theory of angular momentum in SU2. Where you have J3 that plays the role of delta, that measures the spin, and J plus raises the spin, and J minus lowers the spin. And usually we construct representation by constructing the lowest weight state, the state that is annihilated by J minus, say, and we construct representation by acting on the lowest weight state by J plus. That's how you build the representation that goes from spin J to spin minus J. Am I making sense? Is this something you've seen before? Okay. So here it's very similar. So if we have an operator, a primary operator that has dimension delta, which means this, right? Then we can define a descendant. You can define an auxiliary operator, which is the commutator of P mu with O. And then the dimension of this operator is delta plus 1. This is a consequence of the conformal algebra. How will you compute this? You use the whatever thing is called. The Jacobi identity, and now you know the commutator of D with P, that lowers D, you get P with the right sign, so that it increases by 1. And then if you do it with K mu, it lowers it, right? This is very similar to angular momentum again, okay? So this is like a P is like a raising operator for the quantum number we're trying to discuss, which is dilatation, and K mu is like a lowering operator, okay? So a primary operator, in this language, a primary operator is an operator that has the property that is initiated by the special conformal transformation. This is the direct analog of saying that J minus on a state equals zero in SU2 angular momentum. I mean, technically we use this, a prime operator is the lowest weight vector. I don't know if you're familiar with that language, but that's the language. Lowest weight vector in the representation. And then you construct the representation in a very simple way. So now that we know the lowest weight, we're going to do the same thing that we do with angular momentum. We're going to hit with the raising operator. So the representation is going to be this. It's going to be... Yes?
Is this valid for any of the mu choices of mu? Or
for all mu.
Okay. So that's why the index vanishes on the right-hand side.
Sorry?
That's why there's no index on the right-hand side.
Oh, sorry. Because no, there's no index on the right-hand side because I'm an idiot. This should be P mu O. I mean, this operator, P mu O and K mu O are eigen vectors of D if O is a primary operator. Okay.
So is it just the primary operator here?
So the primary operator was O?
Yeah.
Okay, well, here I didn't get specific the primary operator. I'm just saying that I have an operator O that has dimension delta. Then I'm saying that the operator P mu O and K mu O have fixed, we know the dimension because we know how D commutes with P and how D commutes with O, which defines the dimension. So we know that one of them tends to raise the dimension, one of them tends to lower the dimension.
And so the primary operator is the O that satisfies?
This one, yeah. Which is the lowest dimension in the family. That's why we call it the lowest weight. Okay. So now the representation is very clear how to write it. Again, it's very similar to angular momentum. So you start with the lowest weight vector or the primary operator, and then you construct the family by, I'm not going to write commutators, I'm just going to be P mu acting on O. Now, two P mu's, and an infinite number of derivatives. Okay. Now, one important difference between this and angular momentum is an angular momentum, this stops at some point, right? The representations of angular momentum are finite dimensional. There are two J plus one states, right, in a spin J representation. Here, the representation is infinite dimensional because I can act with an arbitrary number of P mu's. And this is just a consequence of the fact that the conformal algebra, SO2, D, is what's called non-compact. Okay, so the dimension of the representation is infinite dimension. Okay. But that's very nice because it means that, and all these guys, okay, so this was the primary. All these guys are the descendants. So, remember I was saying somewhere that everything is determined in terms of the primary, and this is indeed true, but because how does, if O is a primary, how, what's another way of representing the commutator of P mu of O in the kind of plain language? How does P mu act on an operator? When you do quantum mechanics and you give a
translation.
Translations, but how does it act on an operator? Sorry? Derivative, exactly. So this guy is just d mu o. Like when you look into mechanics, you have p and x, right? And p is d dx, right? So p mu acts as a derivative on the operator. So that's very simple. If you know how O transforms, I know how to construct the transformation properties of everyone else because I just have to take derivatives of the transformation of O, which may be a pain in the ass, but it's straightforward. Conceptually straightforward, okay? Good. So
does that mean that O cannot be a polynomial in X? Because eventually.
Well, O is an abstract operator. You can take arbitrary number of derivatives.
Okay.
I mean, it's a function of a field, like say phi of x. Imagine you have a phi of x, you can take arbitrary number of derivatives of phi of x. Now, there are funny things that can happen. There are operators that can have what's called null vectors, where the representation is shorter. We may come back to that. That has to do with conserved currents. OK, so since now we have established that the descendants are completely fixed by just taking simple derivatives of the primaries, now we have to essentially upgrade the discussion we had yesterday about kinematics, about how conformal transformations act on space-time. Now I want to know is how conformal transformations are represented on local operators in a conformal field theory. Okay, so we have to understand how transformation of primary operators under conformal transformations. And actually, this is something that is very simple, and you're familiar from general relativity, in fact. They transform as tensors. That's why they're very nice, these primary operators. They transform linearly, essentially, as tensors. So remember, what was a conformal transformation? That was a transformation x mu to x tilde mu, okay? Where x tilde mu solves that equation I'm going to write schematically, not all the glory indices. Remember? And now for convenience of notation, I'm going to say that x tilde of mu is the action under a conformal transformation acting on x. So it's parameterized by some group element, g acting on x. And g is just a group element in the conformal group. And it has a whole bunch of parameters, right? And what are the parameters of g? Are precisely the parameters of the conformal transformation. So it will be a function of a, omega, lambda, and b, OK? So if I give you an operator, a primary operator O of x, and I want to implement a conformal transformation now, I want to realize conformal transformations in the operators, right? So I'm going to write the transformation rule that implements a representation of the conformal symmetry on the operators. So under a conformal transformation, I get a transformed operator O tilde of x. So what are the quantum numbers of this thing? So remember that I'm going to give a label A. A is a Lorentz spin label. So if it was a vector, it would be like a mu vector, right? But it could have been a spinor, it could be a tensor, whatever. And just for this one time, I'll write the other quantum number that I claim that primaries are labeled with. Remember, these are the maximal commuting quantum numbers, Lorentz spin and dilatation, scaling dimension. Now, I think the answer you know from intuition from just from Lorentz Poincaré transformations. So if this is a Lorentz tensor, the Lorentz transformation will rotate the spin quantum numbers, right? So there's going to be a matrix LAB that depends on some matrix R of X. And it's going to act like this. And where R of X is this orthogonal transformation that we defined the other day. Remember that we said that out of a conformal transformation, I can define an auxiliary space-time dependent Lorentz transformation R of X, which was something like remember? Okay. And R obeyed R transposed R equals eta. So this would be exactly how you have learned in quantum field theory 1 and 2, how an object transforms under Lorentz transformation. It rotates. Notice that the Lorentz transformation has two things. It acts on the spin quantum numbers. So internal degrees of freedom And it also acts on space-time, right? It shifts the operator somewhere else. And we call this like the orbital. So a Lorentz transformation acts both on the spin quantum numbers and also on the position, okay? Which you could call orbital if you want. And this R of X is this auxiliary orthogonal transformation. So this would tell us about the transformation of under spin. But I haven't told you what happens to under dilatations. So under dilatations, it's just a statement that it transforms as a density. Like you know from general relativity, like the square root of g is a density. So here it will be the same. So it will have a something like this. So this is the determinant of the Jacobian, the transformation to the power delta divided by d. This is the space-time dimension. So that's it. So I mean, these transformations you've seen before in general relativity. Essentially, what we've done is restrict. So those transformations you've seen for an arbitrary diffeomorphism. Here, we are looking at this transformation for not an arbitrary diffeomorphism, but for a diffeomorphism that solves this equation, which is a conformal transformation. Now, what are some of the properties that this should obey? So can someone tell me what special property LAB should obey? If I make two transformations, what should L, what equation should L obey? Imagine I make a transformation first g1 and then g2. Sorry?
Because it's a group, it's like the sum of the two.
The sum is not the right word, no.
Okay.
Should be a, I mean, the technical term is that it should be a homomorphism of the Lorentz group. So that means that L, I write it as a matrix, LG1, LG2 should equal what? L of what? G1, G times G2. Okay. So I mean that's just the statement that L is a representation of the Lorentz group. Okay. That's the definition of a representation of the Lorentz group. You give a matrix, L G1 and G2, and the fact that the representation means that it obeys the multiplication rule of the group. Okay. And one exercise that you, if you haven't done, I encourage you to think about. You may think, why did this guy put a G inverse here? Why didn't I put here G times X? And something that I want you to try to think about is that in order for kind of the transformation rule to be compatible with this homomorphism property, it's important that if you act with G on the spin quantum numbers, you have to act with the inverse on the orbital quantum number so that things, so that the transformations connect properly when you make two consecutive ones. Okay. Oh, I want to use this one. It's so cool. What is? Okay. So now let's give some. So for Lorentz transformations, I don't think I have to tell you very much. You have a lot of intuition about that, right? And we know explicitly what those matrices are. If it's a scalar, it's a trivial matrix, right? Just identity. If it's a vector, it's some funny Kronecker deltas with mu's and nu's and blah blah blah. If it's a spinor, you get the gamma matrices, and so on and so forth. But now let's try to understand what happens under a dilatation. Okay, so now let's perform a dilatation. So I send that x, mu, x tilde mu is x mu. And for simplicity, let's take a O to be a scalar. A scalar means under the Lorentz group. So we don't have to worry about spin or anything. So that is L is just the identity matrix. There is no, essentially, there is no index A. Okay. So now, what will be the Jacobian of this thing? So this is just essentially lambda to the minus delta, right? So we get here lambda to the minus delta O of lambda inverse x. So a primary operator transforms under dilatation with some homogeneity of weight delta that tells you the quantum number, essentially. Okay. So that feeds our intuition that under dilatations, things in a scale invariant theory, operators transform in a with some homogeneous property. And now we see that delta kind of measures by how much the operator is dilated or scaled if I perform a dilatation, right? The bigger delta is, the bigger the exponent there is, essentially. Okay. Now it might be useful to, okay, so this is the finite transformation, right? So here I took an arbitrary conformal transformation, a finite one. It could have been an inversion. It could be anything, okay? Now it is also convenient to look at the infinitesimal transformations. So remember that the infinitesimal transformations are the ones where are parameterized by the conformal Killing vector. So now we can compute under infinitesimal transformations. Remember that this was when I take x tilde to be x plus zeta, and zeta is the conformal Killing vector. Now, then we can define the variation of the operator, delta OA. I mean, you must have seen this notation before, the variation under a small transformation, right? This just is OA tilde at x minus OA at x. That's what delta O means, right? And now what do you have to do? Well, that's very simple. We know that x tilde is x plus zeta. Just linearize this to linear order in zeta, right? That's what an infinitesimal transformation is. Just restrict this transformation to the infinitesimal ones and keep terms that are linear in zeta. And then you get this. So you get something that's the orbital part. That just acts by shifting, right? And you shift by precisely the amount that you did the space-time transformation. So like that. So that's, if you wish, the orbital part. Then there is the spin part. This is the part that rotates the spin, internal spin degrees of freedom. Omega is a local Lorentz transformation, and mu nu r is precisely a representation, a matrix representation of the Lorentz-Lie algebra. Okay. And now, in order to read the dilatation, all we have to do is look at this term and linearize. And we already worked this out before. And you get minus delta omega x OA of x. So it means that under a conformal transformation, you get a rescaling of the operator by weight omega. Okay. And now what are these? I have to compute for you what these things appear here. So zeta is just the thing that we did yesterday, just the conformal Killing vector. Now you can ask, what is this omega mu nu? Well, that's easy to work out, given that we know our mu nu, right? So omega mu nu will have two pieces. Where? Can people see here? Yeah. Omega mu nu of x is the usual Lorentz transformation and a contribution from the special conformal transformation. And omega x is the dilation parameter and a contribution from the special conformal transformation. And this ties back with the geometry discussion we had before. That essentially, I remember that I said that a conformal transformation is essentially a local Lorentz transformation combined with a local dilatation. And this is exactly what we're seeing. We have a local Lorentz transformation, omega mu nu, with this strength, or this velocity, angular velocity, and a local dilatation with this weight, which is now x-dependent in general. So that's it. And notice that the primary operator transforms linearly. You start with O, and you only get O here, OK? Any questions about this? Now, something that you can prove by a simple exercise is to show that precisely, imagine you take the first descendant, mu of O. You can prove that if you compute the variation of mu O, it doesn't look that way. The variation of mu O, you should be able to see that if I look at under a conformal transformation, mu O will talk to the father or mother, O, okay? So it's not a primary. It doesn't transform like a tensor. But the important point is that we don't care anyway because we still can compute the transformation properties given the transformations of O. Okay. Now something that you can, so either you can convince yourself that this essentially is fixed by the diffeomorphism invariance of the theory, but and by the fact that this transformation has to be a representation of the conformal algebra. But if you want to be a more down-to-earth way, perhaps a slightly more familiar way of proving that the conformal symmetry is represented on the operators is the following. So remember that yesterday we said that if I take two conformal Killing vectors and I look at the commutator of two Lie bracket of two conformal Killing vectors, I get a new conformal Killing vector, right? So zeta I is a conformal Killing vector. So how would you check that under an infinitesimal transformation, the conformal transformations are a representation of the conformal algebra? What you should check is that if I look at this infinitesimal variation I wrote here, so maybe here I should write delta zeta, okay? If I take delta zeta 1, the commutator of delta zeta 1, delta zeta 2, acting on operator O, A, should give you the transformation under the operator zeta 3. Okay. That's the statement that you have a representation acting on the operators. Okay. And you can take those expressions and check explicitly. Because given two conformal Killing vectors, you can compute zeta 3 in terms of the data of zeta 1 and zeta 2. And then you can indeed check that this is obeyed. So this represents, this implies that conformal algebra is realized on the operators. Okay. So now we know that by a slight modification of how things transform in a Lorentz invariant quantum field theory, and essentially by the same rules that you know from general relativity, we know how the primaries and the descendants transform. So now that we have that, now we can start asking the interesting questions that we care about. Now we want to essentially flesh out the constraints that conformal field theories impose on the observables of a conformal field theory, okay? So now we want to constrain observables that follow from imposing that the theory actually has conformal symmetry. Okay. And you're familiar with this in quantum field theory, standard one, like if you take the two-point function of in a Lorentz invariant theory, you know that the two-point function has to depend on the distance between the points, right? And that constraints like, it cannot depend on x1 and x2 separately, it has to depend on the magnitude of x1 minus x2. So we're gonna try to play this game with these other more fancy transformations and see what you get, okay? Now, one thing, so let me be a spoiler and tell you two remarkable things that happen in conformal field theories that are at the heart of why the theory is extremely constrained by these symmetries. The point I want to make is the following, is that the position dependence of 2 and 3 point functions of local operators are completely fixed . You should be impressed by this. So there is no freedom whatsoever in the functional dependence of the correlation functions as a function of the location of the operators. Okay. And in the notes, I show this very, whoever wrote them, it's written very, very carefully how to prove this. Now, let me give you some intuition just from kinematics of why this has to be the case, or why this is the case. I think this may be, it might be more intuitive than doing arithmetic in the blackboard. Maybe this will be more helpful. OK, so let's start with the harder point, the harder case of the three-point function. So imagine we want to look, and for simplicity, let's look at scalar operators, okay? So that there are no funny A's floating around, because this will just complicate things. The argument actually applies exactly the same, but I'm just going to simplify things. So I have operator O1 at point x1, O2 at point x2, and O3 at point x3. And I want to know what is the most general form that this correlation function can take, what constraints does conformal invariance impose on this. So this will be some function 1, 2, 3 of x1, x2, and x3, right? What is this function? So already you know that from translational invariance and rotational invariance that it can only be a function of the distance between the points, right? X1 minus X2, X2 minus X3, and so on. But they're still arbitrary functions of these quantities, okay? Here for conformal symmetry, the point will be that it's completely fixed. So what's the argument? The argument is the following, is that the point is that we can use conformal transformations to map. So I give you 3 points in space-time. X1, X2, and X3. The point is that by doing a sequence of conformal transformations, and this is geometry only, by a sequence of conformal transformations, I can map 3 completely arbitrary points to 3 fiducial points. Okay, so I can map essentially the point X1, X2, X3. I can map by making conformal transformations. To a fiducial point that can be, we'll call it 0, infinity, and the point 1, 0, 0, 0. So I have d coordinates, right? It's going to be at the point 1, say, in the first coordinate. Okay. So what does this tell us intuitively? It tells us that the arbitrary position dependence of the correlation function is completely fixed by just the value at one point. Therefore, the value at any point is completely fixed. Because I know I can map it to one point, and that's it. There is just one number. Well, it's not a number; it's a tensor. Because it will depend, of course, on the coefficient. The coefficient, the position dependence is completely fixed, but of course, the coefficient will depend on which operators I put here. Okay. So now let's try to prove this. This is very simple. So then I don't have to do the crazy conformal word identities in the blackboard. Okay. So let's try to do it. This is fun. So what are we going to do first? One thing I can try to do is I can try to do a K-mu transformation to send one of the points to infinity. Remember that a finite conformal transformation did this. So take an arbitrary point x, I can tune my b such a denominator vanishes. So that maps that an arbitrary x to infinity. Another way of saying it is that I can do a translation and put, say, x3 to the origin. Okay, I can translate everyone until one of them is at the origin. And then I act with inversion. Inversion maps the zero, the origin to infinity, right? But if you wish, you can think it also this way. I can just take an arbitrary point and just apply the correct a special conformal transformation to map that point at infinity. So that means that by doing a special conformal transformation, I can map x1 to, and this guy to infinity, okay? Is that clear? Now what I can do, I can apply a translation. A finite translation will not move infinity from where it was, but now I can put this point at the origin, right? And this goes to a different point, x2 prime.
What you wrote on the board there, isn't that special conformal
conversion?
This is a special, no, so this is a special conformal. This is I P mu I.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now, I want to make a transformation that allows me to move x to double prime without moving 0 and infinity. Is there any transformation here that does that? Sorry?
Scaling.
Scaling? Any other one? Okay, if we do scaling, we will go from d parameters to d minus 1 parameters, right? So x2 is a d-dimensional vector. It is, there are d components. So an overall scaling, you can change the magnitude of the whole vector, but there is still, it's like a point on the sphere. It depends on d minus 1 coordinates. So is there some other transformation that I can do that keeps 0 and infinity and reduce it and allows to move x2 prime to some chosen point?
Rotation.
A rotation. Because a rotation that connects 0 and infinity and goes through x2 prime preserves 0 and infinity, right? And then what I can do by a rotation m, say, in the directions. It's a bit confusing. So can I call this, because there are two meanings of twos here. One is the point, and the other one is the coordinate of that point. So let me call this point z double prime. So this is a d-dimensional vector, right? So it's x1 double prime, x2 double prime, xd double prime, right? Now I can make a rotation along the directions 1j, where j goes from 2 to d minus 1, sorry, to d, such that I can map this vector. So, okay, 0 and infinity, we already agreed that it's not moved, right? I can map it to a vector x1 triple prime with all other components being 0. Okay? Is that clear? But now I still have one parameter here. And that's when you have now apply a dilatation. A dilatation obviously preserves 0 and infinity, and I can rescale out the length of x1 triple prime and map it to precisely, okay, so to d. So we have seen that three arbitrary points can always be mapped to three canonical points, and therefore all the information about the position dependence is determined by the location of one point. Okay. So this was a slick way of motivating why the two and the three-point functions are completely fixed by conformal invariance. Now you can do the exercise, and it's a fun exercise. Try to do the four-point function. You can think maybe all position dependences are fixed, and what you will find is that the position dependence is not completely fixed. There are what are called cross ratios, which are conformal invariant ratios of coordinates that can appear on the right-hand side. And the reason is that if you try to start with four points, you don't have enough of these transformations to fix the four points. There's always a dependence on actually on a complex coordinate in four dimensions.
Okay.
The more kind of hardcore way of doing this is by looking at constraints. So I'll just take 5 minutes and be done. So what is the statement that, in general, this could be for a space-time transformations, it could be for any global symmetry on correlators. So how do we write this in mathematical equations? And let me write it for a scalar operator so I don't have to keep writing indices A, B, C, D, and go crazy. So the condition of conformal invariance is this. You have an endpoint function of n primary operators, n primary operators, and O tilde are precisely this, right? The fact that this is a symmetry is a statement that this correlation function is the same as the correlation function of the original operators evaluated at the same point. That's what the statement that a symmetry is. A symmetry relates correlation functions to each other. And the relation is that if you take an endpoint function of operator at a given point, that correlation function has to be the same as the transformed operator at the same point. That's the statement of a symmetry, essentially. So now, if you want to be like textbook material, the way you would arrive to this conclusion I wrote here would be to solve these equations. You know how O tilde x looks like, because I wrote it there. You know how, and then essentially you try to solve this equation, okay? And another way of solving this equation is that, let me look at the infinitesimal form. The infinitesimal form would be that the sum from I to n of O1 x1 delta OI xi on vanishes. I just take this equation and I linearize it. I make an infinitesimal transformation and then I get precisely that. Is that clear? That's just the Leibniz rule. And if you wish, you can think of this as a differential equation, because what is delta O? Well, delta O is this thing, right? And these are differential constraints on the correlator. All this is done in very much detail in the notes. And so now you can go ahead and do this for the endpoint function. And let me just write the answer, what it is for the 1, 2, and 3 point function, which is completely fixed by conformal symmetry, which is a big miracle. So the first thing I want to show, I think this should be intuitive, that the 1 point function in a conformal field theory of any primary operator vanishes unless O is the identity operator. So any non-trivial operator has a trivial 1 point function. You know, if you had used translational invariance, well, if you only had translational invariance, what would have been the answer on the right-hand side? What would be the most general solution to the constraint of translational invariance on the 1 point function in a translational invariance theory? Sorry, it's a constant, precisely, because the point x is irrelevant. I can translate it and move it anywhere I want, right? But now dilatations will tell you that constant has to vanish, because if I rescale the left hand side and I rescale the right hand side, the only way that the two are the same is if the constant vanishes, essentially. Now the 2 point function x1 and x2 is completely fixed. And it's x1 minus x2 to twice the dimension of the operator delta. So O is a primary operator dimension delta, and that's the 2 point function. Notice that in a theory that is not scale, it does not conformal invariant, you can try to think of what would be the most general 2 point function in a Poincaré invariant theory. It would be much, much more constrained than this. Here it's completely fixed. It has a power law behavior that is determined by the scaling dimension of this guy. And finally, we can look at I don't want to erase this, the 3 point function. Let me see if I can fit it here. So by writing it this way, I already chosen a normalization for the operator O. I have chosen the coefficient here to be 1. Now the normalization of the 3 point function has physical meaning. So this will be C123, that if you wish are the structure constants of the object. You can think of these as like Nelly algebra. And the position dependence is completely fixed. It's going to be x12 to delta 1, that's the dimension of the first operator, plus delta 2 minus delta 3. X23, by this I mean the magnitude, okay? Of course. So let me. Delta 2 plus delta 3 minus delta 1. And x13, delta 1 plus delta 3 minus delta 2. So you see that the position dependence is completely fixed. There is no freedom whatsoever. And of course, what we don't know how to compute is these coefficients. So I now just finish with the statement that by studying the 2 and 3 point functions, there's a certain collection of data that we need to know to, in order to know the 2 and 3 point functions. What is the data? CFT data. The CFT data is two infinite sets of data. One is the collection of all scaling dimensions, because the scaling dimensions determine the 2 point functions. But also, I need to know all these structure constants. So if you wish, C, I, J, K. OK? And now, the remarkable thing that we will show in the next lecture is that, in some sense, the full conformal field theory, all the correlation functions, are canonically reconstructed given the data delta I and Cijk. The 75-point function can be written in terms of delta I and Cijk. So if you know this data, you know everything, essentially. And we will discuss the equations that, in principle, determine this data. Okay. And we will then use those equations to essentially give an almost solution for some critical exponents of the three-dimensional Isaac model. OK, I'll stop here.